research efforts that we've done here at IMS for the last 7 years and in South Asia. It's a different view of the Dharma, but nevertheless, I hope that you'll find tonight that it's a way in which it gives some validation to the kind of practices that you're engaged in, and a different form of presenting the same kinds of experiences. I'm Dan Brown, and this is Michael Forte, and Michael Dysart and Cliff Cohen will be joining us shortly. They're downstairs inflicting pain on yogis. For those of you who were involved in the pain study, this is research that I do out of my own department at Cambridge Hospital and Harvard Medical School, where I work as a clinical psychologist, mainly running a clinical internship program. And recently we started a program in behavior medicine, and a big component of that program will be teaching people how to use their mind through meditation and visualizations and hypnosis and biofeedback to have an effect on disease, physical disease and psychophysiological disorders. And it's so that the kind of practices that you're all doing here are now catching on in very traditional hospital settings, and they're quite useful. The particular behavior medicine program that we recently started at Cambridge will be a program where meditation and other forms of what are called self-control strategies, or ways of using attention, using the mind, will be used as part of the treatment. This is also a teaching hospital for the medical school, and that it will happen this year that all of the medical students will rotate through this and get this as part of their curriculum. So slowly the kind of efforts that you all are involved in personally begin to have an impact on the culture. Now, the motivation for doing this research for all of us involved in it is to reach an audience about the value of these practices, an audience that's not so likely to see the value of the practices. There are many people who work in the healing professions and health and mental health. Many of them have been in therapy for years, but they're the least likely people to come in contact with meditation and the value of meditation practices. So part of doing the research and the motivation behind that is a kind of skillful means. It's a way of trying to put this in a package of science that people who are not likely to look into meditation and its value, or who will look into it with great skepticism, may begin to understand it through that language. Ultimately, research itself, it's a metaphor, like anything else. It has no inherent value in and of itself. But for some people, it can be a useful means. The true means, of course, is to do the practice yourself, and maybe this is a vehicle for some people to begin to look into that more seriously. The fact that over the years, as I've watched Barry grow, that there are many professional people, physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers who've come here, and that's increased over the years, says something about that this may be useful for some people. And the fact that this is now catching on in hospital settings is encouraging. All of us that are involved in the research are meditators. We have been meditators for a number of years, and doing the research comes out of our own experience, and that's how we formulate the questions. Now, over the years, we've done a number of studies. It started for me with some dissatisfaction about the way meditation research was being done in this country. Meditation research was largely physiological studies, looking at brainwave patterns, alpha wave stuff, looking at changes in The autonomic response, such as breathing, such as heart rate, things like that, mostly in the realm of physiology. And that the early wave of research in that field created a certain view of meditation, that meditation was a form of relaxation, or a relaxation response. Most of you who've sat for the last 3 months know that meditation is anything but relaxing. It's very difficult and painful, often both physically and emotionally. And that the view that meditation was a form of relaxation seemed to be a rather narrow view. It's a useful byproduct of some states of meditation, but it doesn't capture the heart of meditation practice. Although that was the kind of research that was being done and the view that was being presented over the years and the kind of stuff that was fundable. And that's what's really evolved. My own view was I started with getting dissatisfied with that approach and wanted to return to the traditions and to see what the classical traditions themselves had to say about meditation. For me, that meant while I was in graduate school taking the time to learn the traditions and to practice in indigenous settings and learn the languages, mostly working with Tibetan and Sanskrit or Mahayana Buddhism. And living in a Tibetan community and learning the language orally and doing the practices. And then eventually practicing more within the Burmese mindfulness tradition, both here and in Burma. I spent a number of years in there doing translations of meditation texts, mainly from Tibetan. And from doing that, it became clear to me that the way that this meditation was described was in terms of changes in attention and changes in perception, but not changes in physiology. And that the changes in one's way of putting together the world, how we construct the world perceptually, seemed to be more central to what meditation was about. In that early research, one of the things that I focused on was how meditation unfolds over time. There are classic texts that describe the path of meditation, and most of these traditions describe how meditation unfolds as a sequence of stages, and the sequence is quite predictable and invariant over time. For example, in the mindfulness tradition, the classic text is probably the Visuddhimagga, or the path of purification, and some contemporary abridgment of that, like Mahasi Sayadaw's Progress of Insight, which gives a description of how the stages unfold in this particular practice. Other traditions, like the Tibetan traditions, have their own descriptions of the stages. For example, the five paths, the Bodhisattva Bhumis, the stages of meditation in the Mahamudra system. And then taking non-Buddhist traditions, you could go to the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and look at the way the stages unfold in there. One of the things that I worked on was to compare the stages in each one of those traditions in their original languages and going back to the commentaries and trying to piece together whether there was an underlying order to how the mind seemed to work when you meditated for long periods of time. And there were a lot of fruitful things that came out of that. But I don't have time to go into the details of that tonight. But there does seem to be a very predictable way that the mind unfolds for people who meditate for long periods of time. There is a path. But there are several points of view that you can take to the path. For example, between the Hindu and Buddhist systems, one of the major differences is not in the conception of the stages, but the point of view you take along the stages. If you meditate from a Buddhist perspective, you start to see mind moments that come very quickly, and you all have some experience of that through your sitting practice. And they're discrete mind moments, and they come very quickly. If you do the same kind of practice at the same stages in the Hindu system, it doesn't come like that. It comes as a continuous vibration or turning over or transformation of the chitta, or the stuff of the mind. Now, it's hard for us as Westerners to understand the differences. You know, what are they all talking about? But an easy way of understanding that is a classical debate that we know in Western psychology, and particularly in physics, and that's the debate between continuity and discontinuity of the mind. Take, for example, light. Light can be seen as a discontinuous phenomena, or a photon. Light can also be seen as a wave. And it's both those things. And you can construct a series of experiments to show that it's a wave, and you construct a series of experiments to show that it's a discrete particle, a discontinuous phenomena. And they're both correct. And there's something about the ambiguity or the paradoxes built in the universe that make it both of those things. It's both a discontinuous phenomena and a continuous phenomena. Well, the mind is part of that same universe, and you can look at it from two different perspectives, the same way that you can look at light waves. And likewise, in one tradition, there's an emphasis on how the mind unfolds as a continuous vibration of the same stuff, the tanmatras, or the, in the gross level, the chittamatra, in the Hindu system, or in the Buddhist system, it's the discontinuous mind moments. So that's what I mean by that there are different perspectives that you can take in the same samadhi state, but the progression of how the samadhi states unfolds is very clear. Another paradox that's built into the universe and the way we experience that universe in our mind is that between whether things seem to unfold in time, in stages, or whether things seem to unfold simultaneously. And they're both true. For example, in perception research, or an area of perception research called information processing, you can construct a series of experiments to show that the way we process information very quickly is in terms of stages, different steps. You can construct an equally valid set of experiments to show that we process everything all at once, and they're both correct. And the way the Dharma unfolds in your experience is the same thing, that we have stage models for meditation, like in the Vasuddhimagga, where you have distinct states of consciousness in a path or progression. And then we have other traditions like Zen where there aren't clear stages and all seems to come up all at once with a sudden enlightenment. And they're both correct. Because that paradox of sequentialness and simultaneity is built into the universe. And it's a question of emphasis or what perspective do we take that gives weight to one of those perspectives more than another. And they're all true. And this is a way of saying that a lot of the debates that we have between these different traditions are really debates of perspective that are built into the ordinary mind, and we can't escape having those perspectives. And there's a truth in each one of these kinds of practices. And underlying that, there's a structure in it. So we began to try and look at these traditions and compare them and try and get a sense for what that structure was. The second phase of the research was to not to deal with the text and the commentaries in the way that different teachers describe those experiences, but to look at contemporary practitioners, to look at people like yourselves here in this country, and to look at similar practitioners in South Asia, and to see what they said about these practices. Is the way the experience unfolds for each of you like how it unfolds for people that have written about in these classical texts that have been refined over generations? And one of the ways we began to do that was to develop questionnaires about people's meditation experiences. A number of you have filled out copies of that questionnaire. The little things that are sitting on the table upstairs, which are, probably, if you're in a state of mind where you don't think very much, you don't like to think, it's probably tedious to fill out, but there's a certain value in these questionnaires because it allows us to get a sense for how the experience unfolds over time for large numbers of people. In a sense, we're not discovering anything new. We're trying to validate what's already written about in great detail in the classical texts. For example, in Burma, where there are 200 meditation centers, and over the last decades, about 200,000 people have gone through those meditation centers. From Western psychological terms, that's a big N. That's a big number of people. And it's a good sample size to look for the consistencies of the practice. And they pretty much worked it out. Not only is that written about in something like the Vasuddhimagga or the Progress of Insight, but in Burmese there's a companion volume, a large volume that talks about the individual differences that people experience at each one of these stages. So we're doing nothing but, I think, repeating something that's already been worked out and putting it in a more research package. So one of the things that we did was to do these questionnaire studies, which I'll talk about in a moment, and some valuable things came out of that. And then the next thing we did was to do other kinds of research to try and figure out what seemed to change for meditation. Not to go through, we've done all sorts of things here, and every year we try something a little different, but not to go through all of that, I'll say something about the things that seemed to pan out the most. One was a study using inkblots, the good old Rorschach, But we didn't use the Rorschach as a personality test as it's traditionally used. We use it as a perceptual test. We had people look at the ink blots. Do you all know what the Rorschach is? It's a series of 10 ink blot cards. Five of them in black and white, and five of them in color. And you look at the ink blot and you try and say what it looks like or what it reminds you of. You know, and people say that it looks like a bat, or it looks like a butterfly, or it looks like a person, or whatever else. And you make images, you construct images to the ambiguous stimuli of this ink blot. Some very interesting findings came out from that study, which I'll again go over. And then a third area that we've looked into more recently is perception, using a machine called a tachistoscope, which flashes events very quickly in terms of a thousandth of a second or a tenth of a thousandth of a second. And we can, you know, it's your experience as you meditate that things go very quickly, and you train your awareness to pick up very quick events in your mind. Well, is that actually happening, as can be measured by a machine, or is it that just your impression? Is it another illusion that the mind creates? So we wanted to look at whether or not people actually did get quicker in their perception. And you can use these machines as a way of doing that. So that in the last couple of years we looked at that way. And then more recently, because of our own interest in using this or applying the meditation to in the health field, we've been doing a series of pain studies to look at the effect of meditation on the perception of pain, physical pain. In overview, those are the main studies which I want to talk about. Now, probably the most useful way of doing that, rather than reviewing each study, is to talk about how the path of meditation unfolds over time. In the conception of this in any of the classical texts, meditation unfolds in three major stages. The first are the preliminary practices, or the beginning practices, your Shila training, the ethical training, and the preliminaries to meditation. The next is the concentration training, and finally there's the insight training. And those are a series of stages that you go through in the practice, from this particular point of view at least. Of course, there's another way you can do the meditation and there aren't any stages. But to take that as a way of organizing the universe, or a perspective on it, the universe, for a moment. If you go through all of the stages, it results in a permanent shift. And that shift is the first experience of enlightenment. And in this particular tradition of mindfulness, there are four levels of enlightenment, whereas in other traditions it's different. So we wanted to look at people at each one of those major chunks or stages of the practice. So that we wanted to look at the group of beginners, or that includes practically all of us. That's a large span of time. And then we wanted to look at people who had achieved a stable concentrative state or some degree of samadhi. And then we looked at people who had achieved not only a stable samadhi, but were able to apply the awareness in very skillful ways to attain some of the fundamental insights in the tradition, such as selflessness, and were skilled in the way they applied those insights in the ongoing moment-to-moment awareness, applying of awareness in the meditation. And that was the third group. And the fourth group that we looked at were people that were more likely than not to have attained the first level of enlightenment. Of course, it's very difficult to tell if someone has achieved a level of enlightenment. You can tell somewhat from their descriptions, but it may not be accurate. It's hard to tell, but based on the way people describe certain experiences, and based on the fruits of that, the way they act, and the way their meditation unfolds after that, and based on assessment by a variety of teachers, we got a group of people that were more likely than not to have attained that first level of enlightenment, and we wanted to look at the changes that happened in that group. And then we had a fifth group of people who were very advanced and had attained one of the last two levels of enlightenment, the penultimate and the ultimate enlightenment. Of course, that group wasn't very large. And I don't want to say very much about that group for to preserve the anonymity of the subjects that we used. But what's been nice about this is that we've got a lot of cooperation, both from students and teachers in this country and students and teachers in South Asia. So we've been able to look at, in a more systematic way, what seems to happen from a research perspective in the stages of meditation. Now, in the beginning stages, one of the ways of looking at that is in terms of the descriptions of experience with the questionnaires. So in one study, what we looked at was people who had come for two-day retreats here at Barry, people who had come for two-week retreats, and people who had come for three-month retreats. And we tried to see whether there were differences in the way they responded to these questionnaires. For those of you who are here tonight, if you're willing to fill out those questionnaires, I want to put in a plug for it. Every year we collect more of these questionnaires, and the larger the sample, the more accurate the results are. And every year, out of a three-month course, we'll usually get about 20 people, which is a small amount of the total number of people. So it takes us years to collect a large enough group of questionnaires. So if you haven't filled out the questionnaires and you're willing to do that and you see some value in it after tonight, I appreciate it, you doing that.
Even if we didn't fill out the one?
That's fine. That's fine. It's quite useful. To give you some sense of what we found, we did a thing called a discriminant function analysis, but not to get into the technical complicated mathematics of all that. It's a way of isolating factors from the large number of questions on the questionnaire that seem to discriminate the different groups of people who meditate for 2 days and for 2 weeks and for 3 months. And a nice set of items came out of that that seemed to discriminate these different groups. And they were very significant. For those of you who know anything about psychology, most of the significance level was below 0.001. Now the reason that we got very highly significant findings, I think, was because this questionnaire has been revised over a number of years. There's an American version of it, there's a Hindi version of it, and we keep rewriting the items until we find things that more and more accurately describe the nature of the experience. And we've tuned it down now, so we have a good set of items that seem to discriminate between this and other forms of practice, and between this at various levels of practice. One of the earlier studies that we did was to compare, for example, mindfulness meditation to other forms of awareness training or attention training. We compared it to self-hypnosis, and we compared it to practice of visualizations, waking dream phenomena. And there were quite clear distinctions between the people in each one of these groups. People in all of those groups used attention, and there were all ways of training attention. But they weren't the same. Self-hypnosis was much more content-oriented. People would give themselves suggestions, they would talk to themselves, and they would try and plan out things and make things happen. And they would use that experience to explore memories, feelings, and imagery and daydreams as they came up. So it was a purposeful exploration, if you will, of the content of one stream of consciousness. And the emphasis is on the content. And that's very different, for example, from mindfulness meditation, where after a while the content becomes very unimportant. It's the process of awareness, of training awareness and paying attention, that's so much more important. And content still comes up in the stream of consciousness, but it arises and passes away, and it becomes less important. So there are clear differences. Now, at the beginning, most people couldn't distinguish between a hypnotic or self-hypnotic practice and meditation. They all seem like the same thing. But the more you practice, the more you get skilled at discriminating these kinds of things. And the distinctions between self-hypnosis and mindfulness meditation became more clear-cut. In that group, it was also clear that there was a much stronger experience of a variety of intense bodily sensations in the meditation practice, which in the self-hypnosis group didn't happen very much. You get dissociation of body parts, like it feels like your body changes its size and the limbs seem to float off this way and that way. But the great range of intense body sensations didn't seem to come up the same way in self-hypnosis as opposed to mindfulness. to get back to how mindfulness unfolds over time, we looked at the 2-day group, the 2-week group, and the 3-month group. One of the ways of discriminating between those three groups was looking at attention. In the 2-day group, those people had a real difficult time training attention. Most of the way that they reported things on the questionnaire was in terms of getting distracted, the difficulty of paying attention, lapses in their awareness. And that when their mind got distracted, they didn't know quite what to do. And that was characteristic of the 2-day practice. For people who meditated for 2 weeks, and you know, we've collected these for a number of 2-week groups over the years, and a number of 2-day groups over the years, and a number of 3-week groups over the years. For people who practiced for 2 weeks, they learned a certain carefulness of paying attention. But they still had a lot of difficulty when they got distracted. They didn't know what to do. Now, when we looked at the 3-month sample, it was quite distinct from both the 2-day and the 3-week people. They achieved what we called attentional equanimity, which meant that people still reported a lot of shifts in their arousal level, which meant that they got sleepy at times and their mind got very speedy at times. But they were able to maintain some level of awareness despite all those shifts. People still reported a great variation in content and a fluctuation in the stream of consciousness, and yet they were able to maintain some level of awareness despite all that. That was not true of the 2-week people, and it wasn't true of the 2-day people. And this was a highly distinct finding as opposed to the less experienced practitioners. And it really shows a clear progression over time in training a certain balance of awareness so that you can sail the boat through the storm, so to speak. The other factor that emerged very clearly in the 3-month group was a certain skill in bringing the awareness back when you got distracted, that we call emotional dexterity, or the skill in bringing back. Now, you all know that there's a great variation day to day, but when you look at large groups of people on these questionnaires, there's a pattern that emerges. And when you do the practice each day, particularly for this amount of time as you've all done, it's hard for you to get any perspective on that. But it's very clear cut from these findings that a pattern emerges. And this skill in being equanimous with attention and the dexterity in bringing the mind back when you get distracted is very, very clear cut in these findings. It's unquestionable. The next area that we looked at was the area of the content of experience. And that means how, what you actually experience in the stream of consciousness. In the 2-day group, for example, there was a lot of anticipatory thinking, trying to think about what's going to happen when you finish meditating, what's going to come up next in the meditation, what's going to happen when you leave the retreat. In the 2-week group and the 3-month group, that dropped away, relative to the 2-day group. In the 2-day group, there was a lot of proactive thinking, which means thinking about what you're supposed to be doing. Am I meditating right? Is this the way I'm supposed to go about it? That kind of always trying to second guess what's happening next and not staying in the moment. Again, in the 2-day, in the 2-week group and in the 3-month group, that dropped away over time. So that kind of thinking in which you're trying to get at what you're supposed to be doing and what's going to happen next seems to diminish the more you work at this practice. The next area that we looked at was a memory experience. In the 2-day group, there was a great deal of emergence of personal memories. In the 2-week group, not only was the emergence of those memories, but a kind of indulgence in those. They got lost in exploring the personal content of their life history. And they got really stuck in that. In the end of the 3 months, there was a dropping away of that. There was much less concern for the content of your own personal history and the memories that came up. And again, it was quite distinct. There are two areas of content that seem to stay. One was the experience of imagery. And that seemed to get stronger over the course of the 3 months. Although the imagery became more moment by moment, quick flashes of different things rather than long daydreams or dreamlike sequences. And the other was the experience of emotions. Emotions tended to get much more intense over the course of the practice, from the 2 days to the 2 weeks to the 3 months. But there was a way of just letting the emotions stay there and letting them follow their own course without having to act on them. And again, that was quite distinct as opposed to the less experienced meditators. Bodily sensations came and went for the entire group, although there seemed to be less concern for them over at the end of the 3 months than in the earlier groups. They seemed to be familiar and just part of the experience. Another area that we looked at, or the third big area that we looked at, was what we might call insight. Probably one of the most distinct findings, comparing the 2 day and the 2 week and the 3 month group, was in the experience of the self. People who meditated for only 2 days, relatively inexperienced meditators, would identify with the content of their experience. This is my thought. This is my feeling. This is my emotion. The 3 month group was highly distinct from that. There was a kind of a disidentification. You just let the stuff be there, and it becomes more of an impersonal process. There was also a tendency in the 2 day group to keep the self as a frame of reference. I'm meditating. Where at the end of the 3 months, there was no use or referring to the self so much as a frame of reference. It tended to drop away. So these are different perspectives on the experience of the ordinary self. And that ordinary self tends to get less important with more advanced meditators. Now, most of you don't have probably the continuous experience of selflessness. You know, and nevertheless, the findings seem to show very clearly that there's a movement in that direction through doing this practice. It was only true for the 3 month group and not true for the less experienced group. On the other hand, the experience of everything is constantly changing, or a beginning sense of impermanence, was characteristic of the 2 week group. So this is an easier insight to get, and one that one gets earlier in the practice. As you all well know, I'm not telling you anything that's new or unusual. So you can see that the findings from the questionnaire study tend to give validation to the classical accounts of how meditation and practice unfolds, and also probably I'm not telling you anything new in terms of your own experience of the meditation. The main feature of those questionnaires is the difficulty of training attention and the relationship between the attention and content, which means that the content that comes up in your experience tends to distract you from paying attention. And it's hard to just purely pay attention. Another way that we looked at the experience for most people at this stage of practice was to use the Rorschach, so that we gave Rorschachs to people before meditating and then after 3 months of meditating. And there were some differences, but they weren't striking. One of the differences was that there was much more emotional content on the Rorschach after the 3 months. So the experience seems to get more stormy. Now, Rorschachs have been given to other meditators, namely Zen meditators, some 15 years ago now. And the findings from that study were very similar to what we found with mindfulness meditators here. An increased emotional storminess to experience, but not any great changes other than that. Now, what that means is that when you begin to meditate and spend a lot of time meditating, there's a tendency to get so caught up with the experience of the memories and the emotions, you get lost in that. And it's hard to go about the task, which is to pay attention and to train attention skillfully. Once in a conversation with Manindraji, I asked him about, well, why is it that people in this country don't seem to evolve in the practice as quickly, say, as in Burma. You know, many people who take a 3-month course in Burma go through all of the traditional stages in the course of that 3 months. Here, you know, you get 4 or 5 people maybe, and that's a very liberal estimate, who begin to get some sense for the traditional stages in the same amount of time. And his answer was, well, you know, part of it is the cultural differences and the expectations, and part of it is the teachers and the difference. But the main thing he said was, this is very simple. People here do therapy. They don't meditate. And what he meant by that is that as Westerners, we are concerned with the content of our experience. And we tend to get so involved in that, that although that's useful as a growth experience, it's not exactly what the Dharma is about. No, and it's the task of really training awareness in a non-reactive, bare way that's so hard to do because the content's so fascinating. And it's very clear from the research findings that the people who can just do that, just pay attention, tend to evolve through these things quicker. And the people who stop along the way to show interest in the content tend to evolve more slowly. These things are not measured in time, however, they're measured in skill of paying attention. And one of the difficulties we found in our research and others have found is that you can't use simple amount of years of practice as a good measure for advance. Some people do it very quickly, and some people do it very slowly. And you have to develop other criteria to get at what stage of the practice people are at. The next real stage of the practice is the stage where people get very deeply concentrated and achieve a good beginning samadhi. And at that point, there should be little thinking and even little recognition of the ordinary forms of perceptual patterns of the world. Everything is reduced to very quick vibrations in the mind that go very quickly, and you go through hundreds of thousands of these little blips or mind moments in the course of a single sitting. In Burma, they had very specific criteria for what it meant to have a samadhi. You should be able to sit for an hour and not have more than 5 thoughts come up. And you should be able to focus your awareness on those thoughts and dissipate them quickly, just simply by putting awareness on them. I mean, there's a more emphasis in that particular kind of practice in concentration, and it's the concentration that tends to produce that, and that's different from mindfulness in and of itself. But that's another issue. Anyhow, we looked at people who had achieved deep concentration from a research perspective, and one of the things that we did was to both use items in the questionnaire that seem to select for people who are highly concentrated on the one hand, and then use ratings of the different teachers in terms of degree of concentration. So we had 2 independent ways of assessing this. And if they met the criteria for both of those, then we selected that group of people out as people more likely than not to have achieved good concentration. And the Roshaks from those people, the Samadhi group, were very distinct from ordinary Roshaks given to non-meditators. That these people looked at the Roshaks and they saw ink blots. And that's all they saw. Now, they tended to spend as much time looking at the ink blots as ordinary non-meditating people do. But they didn't spend that time coming up with images like bats and butterflies and people. They just looked at the ink blots and they said, oh, that edge there is very interesting. And that color over there is really strikes me, or the shading there really strikes me. But they didn't make images up. And it was so striking that that we asked them to try and make images, and they could make images. And if you really pressed them on it, they could do that. But there was a tendency not to do that. And that wasn't the level at which their mind was operating. It was operating on the level of the pure perceptual features of the ink blot. And that response is very consistent with what the texts say about the nature of samadhi experience. That ordinary, the higher operations of the mind, thinking and pattern recognition, or the ability to make things into form, you don't use those so much. You leave things at the very simple level of just taking in moment by moment what's there before synthesizing or constructing it into more elaborate models for the world and thinking about those models. Now, we used the staff as a control in that group, and the reasoning was that one of the hard things about meditation research is that you can't rule out expectation effects easily. And for example, there was a study done with TM on whether TM seemed to reduce anxiety. And so they used, and you know, there are many studies that show that meditation does this or that, but no one's done careful controls, so that in one study they used TM, and in another study they used another group, they had people sit quietly, and do nothing else. In another group, they had people sit and try and think as much as they possibly could in the same amount of time. They try and cram their mind with junk. Now, in each one of those, they had teachers teach people that and cited bogus research to show that this reduced anxiety. In every one of those groups, the people experienced a decrease in anxiety. But you see, it wasn't due to the nature of paying attention. It was due to the expectation that this is going to work for you. So one of the things you have to do in meditation research is try and rule out expectation effects, because they're so much a part of any change that we experience, both in therapy and in meditation, or even in health. So that the way that we did that was to use the staff, because the staff and the yogis, all of you, all are a part of the same experience. You all have the same expectations that the thing will work. So you're both identical in that sense. You all go to the same Dharma talks. You all believe this works. But the only real difference is the amount of practice per day. Right? The staff meditate about 2 hours a day, and the yogis meditate about 16 hours a day. So it's a good group, because in looking at differences between the staff and the yogis, the differences have to be explained in terms of the intensity of the practice per day. So you can design an experiment that allows you to get at the piece of that that's due simply to practice, as opposed to the piece of it that's due to expectation effects. And in doing it that way, what we found was that these unusual Rorschach changes were only found in the meditators, and not in the staff group who weren't meditating at the time. Of course, the staff who went back to meditate produced those things after the study. We also did a year follow-up to that with people who were still around that we could get Rorschachs on. About half the people we were able to get Rorschachs on. And what we found is that the people kept those unusual effects to the extent that they continued the meditation. And the ones who stopped meditating regularly lost those effects. They had normal Rorschachs again.
When you say continue, you don't mean 16 hours a day?
No, even a day, you know, an hour or two a day was enough. Now, what's that?
But then the staff was really the total control, because some of those people...
Yeah, sure, sure. But you see, what you do in research is if you use very conservative controls like that, that go against showing the findings and you still get clear-cut findings, it's a more solid argument that the stuff is credible. So that's why we did it that way. The other thing that we'd looked at was to look at the tachistoscope, or the way people responded to the perception of simple light flashes. And the reason that we did that was because, you know, for some scientists, the Rorschach is considered soft data. But you can't fool these machines, you see, so that we wanted to look at it in a more hard-nosed way for that particular audience. And Michael is going to say something about that piece of the work.
Yeah, about, I think it was the year before last, we set up our experiment. It was very simple. What we did was we had people sit in front of a viewing hood and look down a long, about 2-yard tunnel at a blank screen. And on that screen, we would flash simple light flashes, nothing but simple light flashes. No letters, nothing, no pictures or anything like that. And what we did was we started out at a light flash which pretty much everybody could see. And then we slowly brought it down so that it became shorter and shorter and shorter until you could just barely see it. Now for each person, this point is different. It depends on whether you wear glasses, whether you've been drinking coffee and are hypo or something like that. But the point is, each person has what's called a light flash threshold. And for each yogi, we determine that individually before they started the 3-month course. We also did it for the staff before they started working on the 3-month course. The second part of it involved 2 successive light flashes. We set the light flashes long enough so that until they merged into 1 light flash. And this level, the interval between light flashes where you could just barely distinguish that there are 2 flashes, was called the interstimulus interval. And again, we tested the yogis before they started the 3-month course and the staff before they started working the 3-month course. Then at the end of the course, during disintegration week, we tested the yogis and the staff again. And what we found was very interesting. It's that yogis could indeed see light flashes that were much shorter in length than before, and they could distinguish between 2 light flashes which were separated by a much shorter interval, whereas the staff didn't change at all. Contrary to popular belief, they didn't get worse. Now, what this shows is that your mind indeed becomes quicker. It's able to pick up information or light flashes that are put on a screen much shorter duration than before, and you're able to distinguish between flashes that come much closer together. Now, both of these are related to viewing mind moments. Mind moments are very short, and so you have to be very quick to pick up a single mind moment. You also have to be very quick to distinguish between 2 successive mind moments. So you can see that it fit in very nicely with what the teachers say about what you should experience as you go on with the practice. And sort of as a addition to that test, we took the T-scope into Cambridge and tested some people from that we knew around Cambridge who weren't meditating, and compare them to the yogis, the staff, and some of the teachers that we had also tested at the start of the 3-month course. Now remember, this was before they even sat the 3-month course, so we're comparing everybody at one single time. And what we found was that the teachers seem to have the quickest mind for both the single light flashes and the 2 successive light flashes. Next came the yogis and the staff, pretty much at the same level. And then the people who could see the longest light flashes were the people who weren't meditating. So you find that even though you hadn't begun the 3-month course, the previous history of mindfulness practice or whatever did have some kind of measurable effect, and it was a long-term effect because it wasn't something that was produced by the 3-month course, it was produced by your whole history of practice. And these types of things are valuable in pointing out that the texts are indeed true when they say that your mind does become quicker, because we have what's called objective evidence. You all can experience it yourself by just sitting and practicing. But somebody who hasn't sat in practice can read these papers and come to the same conclusion that you do indeed become quicker as you practice. And that's basically the whole core of it. It was a very simple, elegant little experiment, yet it gets to the root of what goes on in mindfulness practice.
Seemed a lot.
Well, it was a lot of work, but the whole idea behind it of using simple light flashes, uncontaminated by any content or anything else, is what makes it very elegant, particularly in the scientific circles, because you don't have any contaminating factors of, well, these people are interested in the pictures, therefore they're able to see them quicker, whereas the people from Cambridge weren't interested in it. That kind of thing doesn't even come into consideration, just simple light flashes.
It matches the experience that after a while you just get little blips. Mm-hmm. Light in your mind. So.
What's the time change were you talking about? Did you find?
For detecting simple light flashes, some people would say the average is about 5 milliseconds. no, excuse me, about 10 milliseconds, which is 10 thousandths of a second to see a light flash, people became quicker by anywhere between maybe 2 or 3 milliseconds. It seems very small, but when you're talking about these thresholds, it's a significant effect. So you would say go from 10 to 8 milliseconds.
Visual thresholds are extremely stable. They don't typically change. It takes a lot to change them at all. So the fact that there's any change is quite different from the way these things are conceived in perceptual research.
Did you do a follow-up on them like you did your workshop?
No.
No, because these yogis departed for various parts of the world and it's hard to get them back.
They were also limited by the equipment. This is, we don't have this equipment, we have to borrow it. So that we don't have it readily available when the yogis are here.
In the sampling procedures where you test the people before they come, it's obvious to me that there, as the people come to a course like this, you explained it by saying the past history of mindfulness created the difference between them and the people in Cambridge. If it was all a first-time group, that wouldn't be the case. So my question arises, and I know on the questionnaires you have how many 3-month courses or how long have you been meditating and so on. You must have done some sort of cross-sectional analysis, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Is there a relationship, for example, 1 3-month course and you're there wherever you are, and then each successive...
We don't have a big enough sample to answer that question.
And yeah, again,
I noticed in the one we were in this time that there were several yogis that have been here 3 or 4 times,
yeah.
And it'd be sort of interesting to see if those kind of results hold each time.
Yeah, we look at those kind of questions, but it's hard.
There's not enough sample.
And you know, again, attentional dexterity is not related to just simply coming and sitting. You don't get the benefits by just putting in the time. You have to not only work at it, but learn the techniques of controlling.
So a better way of doing that is to look at the way they respond to the questionnaires and what the questionnaires say about skill and paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I should mention something else. Of all of the yogis who sat the course, every single one of them became quicker. And the only two who didn't were having various problems during the time that we tested them for the second time. I mean, it's like when you're crying, you can't actually see the light flashes that well. it was actually that dramatic. Every single yogi became faster.
Michael, last year when I did it, you had letters.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a separate kind of follow-up experiment?
Yeah, we were trying out on another extension to the same experiment, but the various technical problems, it didn't work out.
Uh-huh. The decision we had to make about how to set the thresholds with that, and there was one or two ways of going, and the way that we went showed very variable results.
Uh-huh.
The other way probably would have shown more clear-cut results, and we had to do both. So
okay.
It means we have to do that again another year. The next stage of the practice is the stage of the insight practice, and that's when you can keep that stable point of view, and there aren't many lapses of awareness, and you can watch the mind moments go by very quickly, and use that state as a vehicle to gain insight into the three characteristics of impermanence and selflessness and suffering. And the Rorschachs in that group were almost the opposite of the Samadhi Rorschachs. Remember, the Samadhi Rorschachs were just the pure perceptual features. The people in that group saw many, many responses. We stopped them at 10 per card, so that means that most of them had over 100 responses. We let some of them go on, and that one of them produced over 300 responses, and it was a 7-hour Rorschach. And then that particular person said that they could continue to produce new responses, so in order to see whether that was true, we gave it again the next day, and we got lots of new responses. Now, if you take a normal person and give them the Rorschach, and you give them the Rorschach a year later, this is a great sameness in the content. About 2/3 of the content is about the same. So it's quite an achievement to be able to constantly turn over the content in your mind. and to do it in such a way that you're not oblivious to the constraints of the way that the ink is actually shaped on the blot. Now, what that means is that these people were in a state of mind where the content was always turning over very quickly. And it was very rich. They would not only give a particular response, but they would tell a story about it, and they would see the same response from various perspectives, and it was always fluidly changing from one perspective to another to another. They would keep turning the same response over and over. Very articulated responses. Every one of the people in this particular group produced Rorschachs like that, independent of the kind of Rorschachs they produced before meditating. So it says something about the characteristics of this state, where you can let lots of different mind states just go through very quickly and run their course without reaction to them. Of course, there's nobody home in there at that point to react to them. We don't have any data from the T-scope with that particular group. Now, those are the three traditional stages of the practice, the beginning stage or the preliminary stage, the concentration stage of the samadhi practices, and then the insight practice, leading up through equanimity. For some people who go through those stages, at some point there may be a permanent shift in experience, that shift being beginning enlightenment, which is characterized as a moment in which all the content of experience drops away. And there's just pure awareness, but there isn't any content. It's called a cessation experience, according to the tradition. And there are several shifts that follow that, the outcome of which is that there's a return, eventually, of the ordinary content of your experience. But something is very different beyond that cessation experience. Now, in ordinary experience, there's the content in our stream of consciousness, and then there's the awareness of that content. And there's a problem, because the awareness is somehow bound up with that content. It gets tangled up in the content. So we're always reacting to the content in various ways. And it's that subtle perceptual reactivity that's the root of suffering. That perceptual reactivity is probably a better translation for dukkha. It gets more to the heart of what that term tries to get at than the gross fruition or consequence of that, which is emotional and physical suffering. See, there's a given or something built into ordinary experience, which is the reactivity that's built into the way that awareness lights upon that content. Now, as a result of the cessation experience, awareness shifts its location. It goes somewhere else, and it's hard to describe that in other than locus of control language. It shifts its locus. Or, you know, using the traditional Buddhist metaphor, it goes to the other shore. What that means is hard to say. But the outcome of that is more clear-cut. And the outcome is that the awareness in the content, in the stream of consciousness, no longer interact. They're both there, but they don't interact. Now, that's a traditional account of the description of the for cessation experience and its consequence. What does it mean? Well, it means that the roots of reactivity have changed. And with each successive enlightenment experience, a consequence comes about that from a more gross to a more subtle level. Now, when we looked at Rorschachs from people who were more likely than not to have achieved that kind of experience, the Rorschachs looked like ordinary Rorschachs. They weren't very different. There was, however, one distinction. One of the distinctions was that in seeing the content, they saw it from two perspectives at the same time. That they projected bats and butterflies and people the way that people normally do to Rorschachs. And yet in doing that, they also said that they were just images of the mind, empty images. So they would see the form, they would make up things, and yet they would say that they were just made up. And it was that dual mode of letting the ordinary world be there, but to seeing it as just a construct that seemed to characterize this experience of the Rorschach. But the ordinary content was there again. You know, the old Zen story of before meditating, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers, and then they were no longer mountains and no longer rivers. And then when you finish the meditation, mountains become mountains and rivers and become rivers again. Well, this, the Rorschachs seem to be like that. The Rorschachs became Rorschachs again. But there was a subtle difference. Now what that means is that you can, we also scored those Rorschachs in terms of content. And that there was a lot of conflictual material that one could find in these Rorschachs the same way one would find in any Rorschach of any ordinary human being. But we also scored them for, there are different ways of scoring for defensiveness against content. And the defensive scores were significantly minimal on these Rorschachs. What does it mean? It means that first enlightenment doesn't take away all human conflict. It means that you will continue to experience whatever the conflicts you have prior to enlightenment. It doesn't, it's not a cure-all for human conflict, first enlightenment. And yet, there's a way in which you can just let the conflicts be there and play them out with minimal defensiveness. And that's some way of getting at what this non-reactivity is about. They're just there, and they may be there with greater intensity even. And yet, because you react less to them, you tend to suffer less. Now, you may make other people suffer, but you don't. You tend to suffer less. And that experience of less reactivity, and yet in the face of ordinary conflicts, was characteristic of these Rorschachs. The other thing that we looked at in this particular group was the TSCO. And it meant asking people to describe the quality of their experience when they looked at these quick flashing events. And Michael's going to talk about that.
I'm a little concerned about the time.
We're mostly finishing up. We can finish in 10 minutes. Okay.
I think one of the interesting things that came out of what we did, actually, was at critical threshold again. Put people right on their threshold for the double flashes and gave them a chance to articulate in a little more detail what they were seeing and how they were going about that. And one of the interesting things that we noticed was that people, some of the advanced meditators, had the ability to shift their perspective, if you will, and move from a more continuous mode attending to the stimuli, from that to a one in which they could see the very discrete mind moments. So in the first case, people were reporting things like the two flashes are really one event, and it has more of a rhythm to it. It's a da-dum experience rather than two entirely separate flashes. And then later on, the same people would explain that it really was clearly two events, and then in addition to being two events, they could see the arising of the first flash, the brief existence of the flash, and then the extinguishing of the flash, the gap, and then the same thing for the second flash. So they were really describing seven different, entirely different events. And again, this is at a very, very rapid rate.
Remember, these are events that happen in terms of thousands of a second. And yet they're still able to discriminate the moment of arising, the brief duration, the moment of passing, the gap, and then the second one. All that happens in terms of thousands of a second.
Very quickly, very rapidly. I'm not sure what else to say at this point, because I really would like to give everybody here an opportunity ask some specific questions. We have so much material.
Yeah, I wanted to say about the last group, and maybe you can fill in the T-scope about that. You'll know what I mean in a minute. The last group were the people that had achieved different levels of enlightenment, and we didn't have a very large sample size. But on the Rorschach, it was very interesting because they tended to view the situation differently from how most people view taking a Rorschach test. They used the Rorschach as an occasion to
teach the Dharma. And in giving responses per card, they would integrate the responses across all 10 cards. So in the first couple of cards, they would start talking about various states of mind, and then in the middle cards, they would start talking about how the practice unfolded, and the final cards, they were talking about the fruition of the practice. That was what one person did. Another person went through the different levels of perception beyond ordinary perception with each of the cards. Now, it's very unusual to try and integrate responses across all 10 cards. It's called a relational style or an integrated style of Rorschach. You hardly ever see this. Sometimes you find it in paranoid people who try and relate one card to the other, but they do it very inefficiently, and they can only do it maybe one card to another. We've never ever seen in either healthy or clinical populations people being able to integrate responses across all 10 cards. And to do that in a way that's true to the form that you actually see on the cards, it's quite a perceptual feat to be able to do that. And these are not idiosyncratic responses about a delusional system that one finds like with a paranoid patient. They're a consensual body of teachings. And to be able to integrate that consensual body of teachings and to present that through the task is quite a feat. Now what's interesting about that, since we don't have a large sample size, is material that was collected by Bryce Boyer on Apache shamans and De Katz on Fiji shamans, not meditators, but people that were spiritual from different kinds of practices. And that one of the things that Bryce Boyer noticed when he gave Rorschachs to these Apache shamans, that there were two groups of shamans. There were the shamans that the culture had questions about, that they didn't know whether they were real or not, and there were other shamans that were really highly respected as genuine shamans. And the not-so-real group produced a lot of clinical Rorschachs. And the real group produced very unusual Rorschachs. The characteristic of every one of these people in that group was this kind of integrated style of Rorschach. Only there, what they did is they talked about the different trips through the different levels of the universe when the shaman had the flight of the soul in their ecstatic flight to find the lost soul or whatever else. Different content, same integrated style of Rorschach. De Katz found with his Fiji shamans the same kind of attempt to integrate across all the ambiguous stimuli. What does it mean? Well, maybe that we might have some sort of marker about high beings that are cross-cultural. There's a particular state that they're in, and that can be tested and looked at with something like the Rorschach. I can't say much more than that, but it seems to be a very unusual finding for this group. The other thing that was unusual about this group was for the different people in this group, they were all clean of any kind of conflictual material. They were clean Rorschachs. Now, what does it mean? Well, it's consistent with what the tradition says, that at the third stage of enlightenment, there's a total transformation, and that all the gross manifestations of suffering are eradicated permanently from human experience. Unlike the initial enlightenment, where you still have a lot of conflict and you react to it less, at these higher levels of enlightenment, there's actually no manifestation, or very little manifestations, of anything like ordinary human conflict. Going back to the Noble Truths, it seems to be a validation for what the Noble Truths are about. It's conceivable to have an experience in which there isn't any human suffering possible. There was one person on the T-scope who, you want to say something about that? About the gapping?
Go ahead.
That, you know, this, one of the things is when you reach first enlightenment, and that's like, it's not terribly stable. And there's in the tradition, there's a thing called maturity knowledge, where you learn to extend that cessation experience for longer and longer periods, and to get some voluntary control over it, so you can actually enter the state for longer times. And there was one person that seemed to have that ability. And what was interesting is, during the work with the T-scope, A number of times they would report that not only the flashes of light, but the whole board would disappear. Similar to what one would expect from someone who had the maturity of that particular cessation experience. The thing that we've done last year and have done a little bit this year is we're trying to look at something totally different from the stages of meditation, but to look more, move in the direction of practical applications. And that's where the pain study comes in. And you want to say a bit about the pain study?
Well, last year we did a study where we had yogis stick their hand in a bucket of ice water and report on how painful that was, and we compared it to once again the staff as a control group to see if it was designed the same way as the T-scope study, where the staff would have the same belief system, but the only difference would be that they had a different amount of meditation experience. And what we found is that the yogis didn't change much in how painful the ice water was. They reported that it was just as painful before as it was after, and the staff reported the same thing also. So there wasn't a big difference. What we did find is that when we tested people off the street, they had they experienced more pain in the same temperature of ice water. So it appears that it showed two things, that it could either be that the yogis and the staff from previous meditation experience had reached a plateau where they experienced less intense pain than people off the street because of the previous meditation experience. Or it could be that certain types of people who already have a high tolerance towards pain or already have an ability to experience ice water not so painfully, those are the types of people that come to meditation. So one of the things first of all, there's a body of research that shows that people who are easily hypnotizable and are easily absorbed into experiences have a high tolerance towards pain. So what we did was we ran a similar experiment, but we brought in other measures to kind of tease out who is experiencing less pain and who is not amongst the meditators, the staff, and control people. We're also looking at this year is to see if there's a difference between, well, there is a difference between the physical sensation of pain and the mental reaction or the psychological suffering that goes on during a painful experience. And we're trying to see, of those two components, which ones change, which ones decrease over the course of meditation. There was a study done on TM using the distress and the sensation components of the pain experience, and the TM study showed that distress does decrease slightly after meditation experience. And we're looking at the same thing now.
The other thing that we're emphasizing in the study this year is, unlike what Michael said about the T-scope, where everyone seemed to change in the same direction, it doesn't seem to work that way with the pain, which means that there are some people through the meditation that tend to experience less distress from the pain in the cold water, but they still experience intense sensations. Other people experience less distress and less intense sensations. Other people experience more distress. So that there are real differences in the way people respond to this, and we're looking at what types of people tend to have what sort of response from this, and it's very, very different. For example, there's some reason to believe that people who are hypnotizable tend to affect pain in a certain direction. People who are more confident about the ability to control seem to affect pain in a certain direction. And these are some of the things that we're looking at. we don't have all the results finished on all of that yet. For those of you who were involved in the pain study, I think we've collected most of the data. It's not completely in this one or two people that we haven't been able to reach yet. And if you haven't finished it, please contact us so we can finish it up.
In that regard, there were two questionnaires that were left downstairs today. I'm wondering if those people are here. They could identify themselves.
They didn't put names on them, so we don't know who they belong to.
Two packets of the questionnaire?
Probably from the staff.
Okay.
Anybody own any of that?
What might be from Gavin?
Did that have the number 6 on it?
I didn't notice.
The other thing is that although that most of you were... most of you came and did the pain thing again. A lot of you didn't come the other day for the hypnosis thing that was part of that. And if you haven't had the hypnosis thing and you're willing to either do that now or arrange a time with us this week to do it, we'd appreciate it because...
What does it mean, hypnosis? You haven't told us before.
I don't think we're part of that, so that it's okay. Some people were part of that. But for the people who did the hypnosis experience prior to the pain study, we need you to do it again if you're willing to do that. If you don't do it, since so few people showed up the other day, we'll have to chuck out that piece of data. And please talk.
Are you going to leave the tape? Or
I can leave the tape, or we can do it either after this or leave the tape, one or the other. Either way is fine.
How long?
It takes an hour, 45 minutes.
So what do you think? You want to do it tonight?
Either do that or else some other time before you leave, I'll leave the tape. Your own choice in terms of time convenience.
Are you saying that the hypnosis should be heard twice?
Yeah, just before and just after. So sometime before you leave, we need you to do that again if you're willing to do that. For those of you who are willing to fill out questionnaires, if you haven't already done that, that would be helpful. Every time there's a retreat, we try and collect as many as possible. And particularly for those people who filled out questionnaires just when you came here, there were about 20 people who filled them out just before they came. If you'd fill them out again, so we can get a sense for how things are now, that would be particularly useful. I have about 7 of those 20 people who fill things out, but again, it's too small a number so that they're not useful unless another 5-6 people are willing to do that. That gives you an overview, I think, of the different things we've tried to do. We'll stay for a bit for questions. So those, you want to stretch before we do that?
Oh
yeah, it's time for bed. Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.